Welcome to Season 2 of The Wayfarer's Guide to Worldbuilding, a podcast for writers by Mythos & Inc. Publishing. I'm Kyle.
I'm Emma.
I'm Allison.
And I'm Christiana.
Today's trope, traveling to another galaxy, aka common methods of long-distance space travel. Special thanks to our patron, Ford Higgins, for making this episode possible. If you're a patron, send us your writing, worldbuilding, or publishing questions for us to answer in our bonus Q&A episodes, which we record as a thank you for our Patreon supporters. I'm Kyle Rudge, he, him, the business and marketing director of Mythos & Inc., and I'll be hosting the episode today.
I'm Allison Alexander, she, her, the editorial director at Mythos & Inc.
And I'm Emma Scramita, she, her, editorial assistant at Mythos & Inc.
The planet is dying. Either humans have destroyed it, a giant asteroid hit the surface, or some other cataclysmic event occurred. Earth can no longer sustain life, and its people must find another world in another galaxy to inhabit. But how do they get there? Or maybe Earth is fine and people just want to go fast. All of it depends on the science of space travel. Hyperdrives, jump drives, warp drives, wormholes, generation ships, and cryo travel are all common methods of transporting people long distances in science fiction. Allison, you're up first.
I decided I would talk about cryosleep in this episode because it fascinates me. And the first example I thought of was Lost in Space. But when I went to rewatch the first episode of the new TV show, I was watching it and it begins with the Robinson family all awake, not frozen or anything, just playing cards inside their ship. And I realized the writers had eliminated cryosleep from the equation. But rather than choose a different topic, I actually want to discuss why that is. So I remember cryosleep from the 1998 Lost in Space movie, which is based on an even older TV show. It's not a very good movie, but I loved it as a kid for some reason. In the movie, the Robinsons plan to make a 10-year journey to a planet, Alpha Prime, that has a mineral Earth badly needs. And once they're there, they're planning to construct a hypergate. And then the people on Earth will have completed their companion hypergate by the time they get there. And then ships will be able to travel between them in the blink of an eye. Hyperspace exists in this universe, but as John Robinson conveniently explains to a reporter, it exists beneath normal space. And if you try to enter hyperspace without a gate, your exit vector is random. Foreshadowing, thank you. So the family goes into cryosleep, the ship takes off, it's revealed Dr. Smith is on board. There's a traitor, yada, yada. Robot tries to kill him. In all the kerfuffle, the navigation array is damaged and they veer off course. The family is woken out of cryo. They have to jump into hyperspace to avoid the sun's gravitational pull, thus becoming lost in space. Now, the 2018 series does include some of these elements, but it's slightly different. The Robinson family is part of a larger mission to colonize a new star system, and they travel there using FTL instead of cryosleep. I have some ideas about why. Most importantly, cryosleep wasn't key to the story they wanted to tell, so they left it out. Cryosleep in particular has repercussions in other scientific areas that you would need to address if you were going to include it in your story. So like, being frozen in time could become a valuable commodity. People who are dying of an incurable illness might pay to be frozen until a cure is found. A government might elect to store prisoners this way so they wouldn't have to feed them or to make transport easier. Think Han Solo in The Empire Strikes Back.
Didn't even think of that. Yeah.
So there's all these sort of things you have to consider if you're going to put cryosleep in there. So I see why the writers were like, let's just use FTL instead. It was simpler for them, I suppose. The new Lost in Space show uses good world building by cutting something from their world building that didn't add anything to the story they were telling.
If the Lost in Space show were to use Kraus, or even the movie, if they were to use it better than what you've explained thus far, how could they have used cryosleep in their story to add to the world building and use it for a better storytelling element?
Okay, yeah. So one trope I really love when writers include cryosleep is, we woke up too early. Oh no, what do we do? It might be you know, overly used, but I still love it. So like the Passengers movie, which was not that long ago released, and received some terrible reviews because it's creepy, but guy wakes up early, ship's not there yet, he's all alone, and then has to deal with all the loneliness and being by himself, and then trying to fix the ship by himself because it's breaking down, and then not necessarily in this order, waking up a girl because he's lonely. Yeah. So I don't know. There's lots of psychological things you can play with when everyone else is supposed to be asleep and one person wakes up. I think that's really fun. That, I guess that wasn't the story that Lost in Space tells. Right. So they didn't go there.
What about if that show you and I used to hate watch, The 100.
Oh, The 100, yeah.
Right, where Monty ends up having to stay awake on the cryo sleep. And and he lives his whole life, and then they have these like leftover journals of this beloved character that's no more.
I don't think he had to stay awake. I think he actually...
Did he choose to stay?
Chose to, and but then lived like out his life. Yeah, lived out his life with... Harper, and they had a kid, and then when everyone wakes up, they're like shocked that he's not there because he grew up and grew old and died. Yeah.
But that would have been neat if they did something like that too in Lost in Space, right? Where there's just this journal of somebody who brought them there.
Oh, yeah, cool.
Totally. There's all sorts of fun things you can do with cryosleep for sure.
In the versions of Lost in Space where they do use cryosleep, even when it's not shown, are there any after effects? Like, do they have any muscle atrophy or anything like that because of cryosleep? Or do they come out exactly the same way as they went in?
So in the movie, which I've never seen the show, I'm only familiar with the movie. I mean, I've seen the new show. I didn't watch the very old show. They're in cryosleep for like a grand total of 20 minutes or something. So like... they go into cryosleep, then a few minutes later, Robot wakes up and tries to kill them, and then they get woken up by Dr. Smith because he doesn't want to die on the ship. So, however, one of the kids, what's the oldest girl's name? One of the Robinson kids won't wake up from cryosleep. There's some issue. And that is the story reason that they use for keeping Dr. Smith alive, because he can save her. So he uses it to barter for his life. He's like, I can save her. You can't throw me off the ship, because the pilot just wants to toss him, because he's like, yeah, traitor. So there do seem to be like some potential health risks of using cryosleep, but they don't really go into details beyond using it for that plot point.
Well, my example, my offering to the world of faster than light travel has got to be my favorite sci-fi series. I don't know if it's my favorite, actually. I was thinking about this. There's been so many, like I've loved Discovery, Orville was up there. There's been so many that have really struck me, but one of my favorites, I'll go with that. I did name my son Hilo. So Battlestar Galactica has got to be there. The premise of the show is that it's an effort to create a better world. Humans built a bunch of smart robots to do the work for them. The robots are built. They left only to come back decades later with the plan, i.e. to eradicate humanity as we know it. And the main ship, Galactica.
Typical robots.
I know, robots can't be trusted. The main ship, which is the Galactica, where everything takes place, it's an old military battleship that's set to be decommissioned after decades of successful service. It's breaking down, etc. And then the Cylons attack, and the Galactica and like 30,000 humans are all that survive. So that's kind of the premise to the entirety of the story. Galactica uses a faster than light jump drive. So it's a process where the space around itself distorts, and the ship will jump to another determined spot in space. The calculations required to successfully jump into space and not into another ship or an asteroid field or a planetary atmosphere or even inside another star, they're immense and super particular and very, very complicated. We don't ever see what they are. We just really get to like, you need to make sure, you know, every number is correct kind of stuff. A blind jump, which can be done with no calculations, but it carries extreme risk because, of course, ending up in the middle of a star is not a good idea. Anyways. That's the whole premise of what this thing does. Why is it good world building? Well, in the first episode, it's called 33, it really highlights what you can do with a jump drive. The humans are on the run. They jump. They're trying to get away from this massive Cylon army. And these giant Cylon battle star ships follow them with their own jump. And every 33 minutes, they follow again. So the humans, they run, and then they have 33 minutes to prepare for the next attack. And then 33 minutes, 33 minutes. And they set a timer, a countdown timer, 33 minutes. And on the zero, the Cylons jump back.
Such a good episode.
And they do this for 130 hours. That's 5.5 days. Calculating one jump. Easy. Two can easily be done, but over 250 jumps back to back to back with no sleep, operating on artificial stimulants, hoping and praying you don't make a mistake and end all of humanity as you know it is hard. It's good world building because it's not just a wave a magic wand and the jump works and you're out of it. It's not like this Deus Ex Machina answer to a problem. Instead, it demonstrates that every jump carries extreme risk. And when their last jump is made and one ship is missing, you feel the consequences of that risk. Who screwed up? What happened? Why are they gone?
Are all the calculations in Battlestar Galactica done sort of by hand or by people, or do they have computers or AIs that do some of that processing work for them?
So it's an interesting thing because when you're confronted with a massive, essentially robotic artificial intelligence force where you may have spies on board, you are slowly pulling away from your reliance on computers. You still have to use computers in order to do some of the calculations, but there is a lot that is being done by hand and transmitted in encrypted patterns because they're being followed and they don't know why. They don't know how they're being followed. And so they're essentially like, we need to bring our technology back because maybe the technology is compromised, but we still need to do it to get away. So it's kind of a both and of like, they're trying to get we got to go back to analog. None of this digital stuff.
So I don't know if you mentioned that the Battlestar Galactica ends up collecting like a big fleet with them. It's not just the one ship, but is it always the Galactica that has to like how does the technology of the space jumps work? Does the Galactica have to be the one to calculate the jumps and then everyone else somehow follows? Or does every single ship have to do the same calculation?
Okay, so the way that it's set up is that there are most of the other like civilian ships that are there. They all have jump drive capabilities. Some don't. And so they kind of piggyback with some of the other ships. So they're kind of smaller ships. And so as it says, like the space around the ship will kind of distort. And that can damage other ships, that if you go too close to it when that happens, ships get damaged. But sometimes smaller ships can hide in that.
Hide in there and go
along for the ride. The way that it's done, though, is Galactica is the one that's doing all the calculations and then they're essentially transmitting the answer to each of the ships, which is a very, very long, precise set of, you know, quadra-dimensional coordinates, I guess, of what they need to do. And then they just follow that to a T at that point.
So when one ship was missing, someone on the Galactica made a mistake and didn't
send them
the coordinates.
Were the coordinates not sent? Were they not followed? Were they wrong? All of those things? Or did their jump drive fail? What happened? You don't know.
Tension.
Very much so. Very much so. It's such a good episode. 33 has got to be my favorite episode of the entire series, which sucks when it's the first episode, but you know.
You can only go down from there. So my example contains elements that are similar to both of your guys's from before, which is interesting because it seems like there's a lot of similarities in how authors come up with long distance travel. But mine is from a book called The Long Way to a Small Angry Planet by Becky Chambers. I read this book recently for the first time, and it's become one of my all-time favorite books. It's so good, and I've everybody should really go good. Read it. Yes,
it's on my to-read list.
Oh, read it right away. It's so good. But in this book, and so I'll try and be as less spoilery as possible for Allison and anybody else who may not have read this book, but in this book, tunneling is how people in this futuristic universe travel long distances. So a tunnel isn't naturally occurring, but they are rather punched through the fabric of space into the sublayer, which is described as the space between space, and then back out into space at another point in the universe. How many times can you say space in one sentence? So this process, this punching, is done with a giant machine called an interspatial bore. As the bore is punching through all these various layers, boys are dropped from a ship. So that's B-O-U-Y-S, not young males, are dropped from whichever ship is doing this punching. And these they're dropped to A, keep the tunnel open behind the punching ship, and B, to generate an artificial space so other ships can travel through it like normal, instead of experiencing what the sublayer is normally like, which is described as being kind of like a drug trip, and it's incredibly unpleasant to go through. Then something called a containment cage is placed at either end of the tunnel, acting like a doorway. Once all of this is in place, you've got your tunnel, you've got your cages, then you have a functioning door, and you can easily pop from one spot in the universe to somewhere else in the universe, really, really, really far away. Piece of cake. The tricky thing comes when you're creating a tunnel to an area of space where no other tunnels have been set up yet, because you have to do a blind punch. That is, punching through to where there is no cage already set up. If you have your two cages already on either end, it's super simple to just punch through from one. You can be guided to the other one. Super easy. If you're doing a blind punch, you have to navigate through the sublayer, pop up, and then scramble to set up your cage before everything collapses. Tunnels with only one cage at the end are incredibly unstable, even with the boys. The sublayer itself exists outside of regular time and reality, and is impossible for most species, including humans, to navigate. This makes blind punches really unpleasant, really difficult, and only very specialized crews will undertake them. If you don't get the second cage set up in time, things can go really badly, including you can tear the fabric of space, and that's about as bad as it sounds.
Uh-oh.
Now, this is all a bit of a complex procedure, but I do think it's good world building, and that's because it addresses some of the mundanities that would exist even in a high-tech world. So as I mentioned, there are crews that undertake this work, and that's actually the plot of the book revolves around one of these crews who have this job of essentially doing intergalactic construction work. And I think that's kind of cool. A lot of sci-fi is totally automated and really, you know, everything is just kind of done already. And that's cool in its own right. But it's also neat to see examples of how humans and other alien races would have to build things and have jobs, even in a really high-tech society. It gives this particular world a really down-to-earth, lived-in feeling, and it feels really real. And I also like that the science of this explanation has enough fake explanation to sound plausible, but not so much that it really drags everything down. And Chambers does a really good job in communicating it, because she has one scene where a senior crew member explains the process to a junior crew member. And then after that, they don't have to keep explaining it because we already know.
Mm. They've gone through the tutorial.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Love it.
One snap.
I love how it's described as this is a story about interstellar construction workers. That's really, yeah, I love that. that's the byline I want. Interstellar construction story. My question is to deal with the types of characters that are on the crew. You talk about how going through first is kind of a trippy experience. So immediately I'm thinking, it's just a bunch of like hotshot hippies that enjoy this experience going through. But how does that trippy experience affect the crew? And what kind of characters interact with it? How does it affect them differently?
Yeah, so it's really neat because this book, like a lot of, you know, sci-fi or fantasy books, has your one newcomer. So we are introduced to the ship through Rosemary, who is a newcomer to the ship, whereas everybody else on the crew has already been doing this for a while. So, of course, Rosemary has a terrible experience when they're punching through. She like throws up and it's, you know, is having a really bad time. On the other hand, their mechanic, whose name is, let me just double check, Kizzy. So their mechanic Kizzy talks about how actually in mechanic school, they make you prepare for this by giving you like drugs and then making you do like mechanic stuff, like fix this while you're on this drug to get ready for doing stuff like this. So it totally runs the gamut of different experiences. And it is really cool that you get to see, you know, all these different reactions. And then it's cool because there is actually, like I said, humans can't navigate the sublayer, but there is a species of alien which can navigate the sublayer, and they're pretty cool. And they do have one of those on board as well. And they do the job of sort of getting them through to where they're supposed to go, which is really neat also.
So if humans can't, what do you mean by navigate? Like they can't see it, they get too sick, or like, how does that work?
Yeah, so in the book, it's actually described as sort of being indescribable because it exists outside of like regular time and reality, and human brains just cannot comprehend it. Kizzy describes it as being like telling a human to see in infrared. Like you can't, it's just not something that our brains can do. But there is a species called the Synat, which are able to, I guess, see and comprehend, and their brain does work in this sort of extra reality way. So they are able to, you know, point the ship in the right direction and kind of get it to a spot in the sublayer that corresponds to a particular spot in real space where you can then pop out.
Are there any repercussions in society because humans can't do this thing and this one alien can? Like, are humans kind of seen as lower or like higher than, oh, we don't do that, that's a mundane job?
No, so humans are seen as lower, but actually not because of this sublayer navigation thing. Most alien species actually can't see in the sublayer. So humans are seen as being sort of lower because we're a very violent race and we've only recently sort of joined this interplanetary confederate, right?
Typical humans.
So yeah, so there, while humans are seen as lesser, it's not for this particular reason. This
got such a bad reputation.
Get our stuff together, Earth.
Yeah.
Oh man, I want to read this now. I have so many questions, and there's questions that I want to ask that I'm like, I'm pretty sure that's a spoiler if I even ask the question.
Don't ask it. I want to read.
That's fair. But we okay. Before we go on, we have hang on. We have some announcements, but before we even get to those, we want to talk a little bit about the podcast. And if you think it's a dollar's worth of education or entertainment, consider supporting the show through our Patreon at patreon.com/mythosandink. We need to reach 30 patrons, or when we reach 30 patrons, we will record a bonus episode of the podcast for patrons only, in which the host will discuss the science fiction and fantasy worlds that have influenced them the most.
I can guess what Emma's is.
And we'll also, if we reach whoever the 30th was, maybe they can put a ban on one. No, I'm just kidding.
Ban Ender's Game. Ban Ender's Game.
We're very close to 30 patrons, though. Yeah. So yeah,
we are very close. And all you need is just a dollar a month. And we really, really appreciate
less
that.
Than a coffee a month.
Okay, the questions that you should ask yourself if you decide to play with this trope in your world-building efforts. You know the trope of traveling across the galaxy. You know, space travel of some type. Allison, you're up first.
Remember that technology doesn't exist in a vacuum. If people use a technology like cryosleep for long-distance travel, what other uses might it be put to? For example, would they put people with incurable illnesses into cryosleep until a cure can be found? Could faster than light travel be used as a weapon? What does the science behind generation ships, which are enclosed ecosystems, mean for habiting new planets?
It's funny. You said, remember that technology doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's like, but it's in space.
It sort of does, because it's kind of,
I was like, you missed a great opportunity.
Remember, technology does exist in the vacuum.
Remember that while a jump drive to travel faster than light is inherently cool, using it just to solve all your problems isn't all that cool. Mm. What are the stressors, the challenges, the complications of using something like a jump drive? How, or any faster than light drive, but how do those challenges affect your characters in the day-to-day? What happens when it breaks down? And if you do that red button Deus Ex moment, how do you subtly set it up early so that it really does blow the audience away or the readers away when it finally gets pushed?
Mm. Push the button.
Push the button. I didn't think he'd ever push it. I didn't see that coming.
And lastly, consider how the ease or difficulty of long distance travel affects the societies of your world. If it's easy, has the universe equivalent of globalism taken place? How are different species and cultures interacting? If it's difficult, what effect does this have on those who undertake the journeys and those left at home?
The hosts of The Wayfarer's Guide to Worldbuilding are also staff at Mythos and Inc. Publishing, where we publish books for geeks by geeks. At the end of each podcast episode, we'll give you a little insight into the world of book publishing by sharing what we've been up to. Allison?
I am almost finished writing Making Myths and Magic, a field guide to writing sci-fi and fantasy novels. I'm co-writing this with fantasy author Shelley Campbell, so you get an editor and an author's experiences in there. We're like 80,000 words in. There are 3 chapters left. It's almost done.
Oh my goodness.
And funnily enough, I just finished writing an episode writing a chapter on sorts of science you can include in science fiction. And I talked about 6 different types of long distance space travel. So if you want to learn about the 3 that we did not talk about on this show, no, grab a copy when it's up.
Making Myths and Magic. We will definitely talk about that more as the episodes go on.
For sure.
You will know about it. For me, Winnipeg is actually hosting its first in-person convention, like Comic-Con, in like a long time this weekend.
Ooh, yeah.
So we didn't get a booth this year because, you know, pandemic things and uncertainty and etc. But I was hoping to make it there and maybe network with some artists, but there's also some large group anxiety that I'm still feeling in a post-pandemic mm-hmm. life, apparently. So it's not what I've been up to. It's what I might be up to at this point.
And school is just starting around this time. So, or it will have been for about a month. It's scary.
And I have been busy proofreading our next fantasy novel, which is Voice of the Banished, sequel to Under the Lesser Moon by Shelley Campbell. This book is fantastic. And once I'm done proofreading it, it will have absolutely 0 typos. So, and if you want...
There's always one you'll miss.
No. There will be none. There will be none.
And if you want to challenge me, buy a copy of the book, read it for yourself, and tell me if you find a typo. That's my challenge to you, listener.
I will say this. That Emma will personally apologize to you on the podcast to the first person to find an error in proofreading.
Deal. A personalized, sincere apology.
You have to have purchased the book and be the first person to submit an error to us, and we'll go with that.
Yes.
I will also add, it's been 2 months since the cover reveal for that book, and I'm still just blown away by it.
Still love it just as much.
Yeah. Oh, my word.
Can't wait to have that on my bookshelf.
And being on the marketing side of things, right? Like, I'm in the dark as to the story. Like, I got to see the first version of it, but it's so radically changed from that. Mm-hmm. So I'm very excited to actually read this book. All right. Well, if you are looking for a sci-fi and fantasy writing community on Discord, go to mythosinc.com and join ours. If you have any questions, suggestions, or comments, email us at podcast@mythosinc.com or tweet us at mythosandinc. Until next time, fellow wayfarers, go build worlds. Bye.
Bye. Bye.